We know what is needed, absolutely needed, to reduce emissions. And that speaks to actions that need to take place in the fossil fuel space. That is where focus needs to be placed. So whether geoengineering has a role to play or not, I see right now some interest in technology, unproven, keep doing the research, but right now let's not get distracted from the concrete actions that governments, sectors, businesses need to take, that we know what needs to be done, we just got to do it.
That's Simon Steele speaking at London's Chatham House. Simon is the Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Yes, and this is the latest episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It's great to have you along. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton in Northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. In the past, I would share a few minutes of what Simon had to say, and then in the show notes, you would find a link to the actual event. But today it's different, because I think what Simon had to say was so important that we all should be listening to what he had to say. I didn't want you wandering off looking for other links, and so I decided best if I shared the whole audio. The host for the show is Annie Yang from Chatham House. She is the Executive Director of the Sustainability Accelerator from Chatham House. Let's have a listen now to what Anna and Simon had to say. Before we go any further, I need to mention that I am the host of Climate Conversations, Robert McLean.
So before I hand over to Simon, just a very quick sort of things that we work here on Chatham House. We have a big team that works on Environment and Society Centre, and we look across complex systems and how that intersects with the shifting global geopolitical landscape. And a lot of what we do is to help change and then shift, you know, move towards a sustainable and equitable and safe future. Things that we do are we host coalitions to drive systemic change. Examples are the Alliance of Champions for Food System Transformation that was launched at COP29. The accelerator that I run, Incubate Initiative, we foster safe space for partnerships to happen and deep collaborations to occur. And one of the things that we're incubating is a bio-based future transition. And we also obviously do quite a lot of sort of deep influential research around a range of topics from cascading climate risks, rising competition for land. Check out that report, really, really cool. We also published a report on what happens if we breach the Paris Agreement. And me, as a Brazilian, for those who know me, and I've been working in Brazil for many, many years, we also worked on the report a couple of years ago on how we rethink the social and development trajectory of Brazil. There's a couple of copies there. But with that, Simon, over to you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Anna. So, 2 years to save the world. Good afternoon. Some of you may think the title of today's event is overly dramatic, melodramatic even. So let me start by explaining why the next 2 years are so essential in saving the planet. First, we know the stakes. You've heard me talk about time and time again, the shattering heat and massive damage that climate change is causing to our economies, and how there is no room for half measures. Let's take all of that as a given. Second, we are at the start of a race which will determine the biggest winners in a new clean energy economy. And with the global index of living standards in constant flux, each country's climate responses will be key to whether they rise up the ladder or fall, whether they thrive or barely survive. Third, for many countries, they will only be able to implement strong new climate plans if we see a quantum leap in climate finance this year. Fourth, it's about how the Paris Agreement works. As of today, national climate plans in aggregate will barely cut emissions at all by 2030. We still have a chance to make greenhouse gas emissions tumble with a new generation of national climate plans, but we need these stronger plans now. And while every country must submit a new plan, the reality is G20 emissions are around 80% of global emissions. So G20 leadership must be at the core of the solution, as it was during the great financial crisis. That's when the G20 came of age and showed major developed and developing economies can work together to avert global economic catastrophes. Fifth and finally, every citizen in every country has an opportunity to be part of this transition. Every voice makes a difference. This year and next, we will need every voice more than ever. Let's consider for a moment what's up for grabs if we do make the next 2 years really count. Bold new national climate plans will be a jobs jackpot, an economic springboard to boost countries up the global ladder of living standards. In the face of crop-destroying droughts, much bolder climate action to curb emissions and help farmers adapt will increase food security and lessen hunger. Cutting fossil fuel pollution will mean better health and huge savings for governments and households alike. The transformative potential of bold climate action in tandem with steps to advance gender equality is one of the fastest ways to move away from business as usual. For those who say that climate change is only one of many priorities, like ending poverty, ending hunger, ending pandemics, or improving education, I simply say this. None of these crucial tasks, indeed, none of the Sustainable Development Goals will be possible unless we get the climate crisis under control. In fact, business as usual will further entrench the gross inequalities between the world's richest and poorest countries and communities that unchecked climate impacts are already making worse. These inequalities are kryptonite for cooperative global climate action, and every economy, every country, and its people pays the price of that. To start curing this global cancer of inequality, we need to enable bold new national climate plans by all nations that protect people, boost jobs, and drive inclusive economic growth. And we need them by early next year. The next generation of national climate plans must be investment plans for sustainable and strong economies. Which brings us back to the crucial importance of climate finance, because it's hard for any government to invest in renewables or climate resilience when treasury coffers are bare, debt servicing costs have overtaken health spending, new borrowing is impossible, and the wolves of poverty are at the door. The quantum leap this year in climate finance is both essential and entirely achievable. Everyday finance ministers, CEOs, investors, and climate bankers and development bankers direct trillions of dollars. It's time to shift those dollars from the energy and infrastructure of the past towards that of a cleaner, more resilient future, and to ensure that the poorest and most vulnerable countries also benefit. This year, at COP29 in Baku, we need to agree a new target for climate finance that meets developing country needs. But it's not enough to agree a target. We need a new deal on climate finance between developed and developing countries. That deal should have four key key components. First, more concessional finance, especially for the poorest and most vulnerable countries. Second, we need new sources of international climate finance, as the G20, International Maritime Organization, and others are currently working on. Third, as Prime Minister Motley and President Ruto have made clear, we must reform development banks to make them work better for developing countries, embed climate in their decision making, and build a financial system fit for the 21st century. And fourth, debt relief for the countries that need it most, to give them the fiscal space for climate investment. Developing countries spent more than $400 billion servicing debt last year. Experts have shown that if we do all of this together, we can meet developing country needs, mobilizing hundreds of billions of dollars. Ever closer cooperation between international institutions is more important than ever. I offer UN Climate Change's partnership wherever it can help to support stronger and faster climate-related outcomes. To the World Bank, IMF at the upcoming spring meetings, to the G7, G20, and their finance ministers, together we can make this deal real. Together, we must step up the pace. The spring meetings are not a dress rehearsal. Averting climate-driven economic catastrophe is core business. It can't slip between the cracks of different mandates. We can't afford a talk fest without clear steps forward. When there is an opportunity to make real progress on every part of the new climate finance deal, all nations need. At the spring meetings, we need an ambitious round of replenishment for the World Bank's International Development Association, IDA. Doing so could lift hundreds of millions of people out of poverty and increase clean energy access, especially across Africa. Progress in Washington, D.C. on revising the World Bank's capital requirements could free up billions more for concessional lending without asking donors for more money. Next, to help give countries the fiscal space they need for climate action, the IMF can help more countries deal with debts made worse by climate change and the pandemic. For example, by making more use of the Catastrophe Containment Relief Trust, the World Bank's work on climate-resilient debt clauses, which allow countries facing supercharged storms to focus on recovery, are another welcome step in the right direction. Eligibility should now be expanded beyond small and island states to more countries and more climate impacts. The G7 has a crucial role too, this year chaired by Italy. G7 governments are the key shareholders in the World Bank and the IMF. In truth, they provide both capital and direction. With their say-so, these institutions can do much more to use all the tools at their disposal in delivering large-scale impacts on the ground. It's entirely in the interests of every G7 country to take much bolder climate action at home and abroad, including on climate finance. Firstly, because serious progress on climate finance is a prerequisite for bold new national climate plans from developing countries, without which all economies, the G7s included, will soon be in serious and permanent strife. Secondly, because resilience building is equally urgent to protect the supply chains that all economies depend on. We've just seen what the supply chain disruptions flowing from COVID did to inflation and to households and businesses. Well, you can bet your bottom dollar these disruptions and inflationary impacts will only get dramatically worse without bolder climate action. So too, the world needs the G20 to rise to this moment. We're all aware of geopolitical challenges. I do not downplay them. But they cannot be an excuse for timidity amidst this worsening crisis. So I'll be candid. Blame shifting is not a strategy. Sidelining climate isn't a solution to a crisis that will decimate every G20 economy and has already started to hurt. So the financial firepower the G20 marshalled during the global financial crisis should be marshalled again and pointed squarely at curbing runaway emissions and building resilience right now. Brazil, who also hosts COP30, has a vital role to play to kickstart the ambitious action we need. I'm encouraged that the G20, under Brazilian leadership, is exploring ways to find new finance for climate and development. Brazil itself is also trialing new ways to reduce unreasonable borrowing costs for clean energy, which could work for other developing countries. Ultimately, it's not enough to invest in clean energy and resilient infrastructure without measures that also speed up the decline of fossil fuels. Stronger domestic progress on carbon pricing is essential to reflect the real economics of fossil fuels, including the massive health and economic costs of greenhouse gas pollution, which should not be shunted onto governments, households, and other industries to pay. So when I say we have 2 years to save the world, it begs the question, who exactly has 2 years to save the world? The answer is every person on this planet. More and more people want climate action right across societies and political spectrums, in large part because they are feeling the impacts of the climate crisis in their everyday lives and their household budgets. Rising costs for fossil fuel power transportation, for heating and cooling, energy, rising food prices as climate disasters hit production and supply chains, to name but a few. A recent survey by Gallup of 130,000 people in 125 countries found that 89% want stronger climate action by their governments. Yet too often, we're seeing signs of climate action slipping down cabinet agendas. So there is a disconnect, because in living rooms around the world, climate impacts and costs are rising quickly up the list of household worries. The only sure way and surefire way to get climate up the cabinet agenda is if enough people raise their voices. So my final message today is for people everywhere. Every voice matters. Yours have never been more important. If you want bolder climate action, now is the time to make your voices heard. I thank you.
That was the Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, Simon Steele, speaking at Chatham House.
Amazing. Thank you. I heard the call to action. Thank you. So we're going to have about 10 minutes. I'm just going to use the purview of chair for us to have a conversation. And then I'm going to open for us to do a Q&A. You're here at Chatham House, right? And everything that we do, the research we do here, has a geopolitical and international relations lens. And I think the concern, things that are on top of our mind, is we have a really short time frame to deliver this collective challenge ahead of us. But we're also facing this quickly shifting geopolitical landscape where this year, you know, and I don't want to use the East and West, but I think a lot of countries are going through democratic, democratic or undemocratic electoral processes. There are multiple crises happening around the world. It's like, how do we, and in the absence of a more leadership from specific groups of country, like how do we push this agenda forward?
Well, as I said in my remarks, the focus on what progress is made over the period ahead of us has to be focused on those within the G20. Mm-hmm. 80% of emissions, 85% of the global economy. So the problem lies there, so do the solutions, so do the resources. I think what has been called into question is the effectiveness of the Paris Agreement. Mm-hmm. And what we have seen since 2015, even though we're far from where we need to be, progress has been made. And the Paris Agreement is demonstrating its robustness. We saw that in Glasgow. We saw that last year in Dubai with the outcomes of the global stocktake. So yes, a lot more progress needs to be made, but progress is being made. The crucial question is how do we spend the next 6 years in accelerating the action that, you know, momentum is building, but how do we accelerate that?
Yeah.
The global stocktake kind of showed us a pathway forward. What happens this year in terms of finance, the means of implementing the pathway that's been presented to us, and the means of implementation to support this next round of NDCs is going to be absolutely critical. So the spotlight is what we do or don't do in this period ahead. And again, as I said in my comments, I mean, we find the world seems to be unable to deal with multiple crises at any given time. But when we look at some of the global challenges that we face, without addressing climate change, those problems are not going to go away. So it's putting climate change and climate action within the context and that lens of this is what we need to do. If we're not only able to address this climate environmental catastrophe, but to also address other economic and social challenges, developmental challenges that currently exist.
Yeah, and I mean, I've been working in this space for a long time as well. And I think what we see is, in my view, transition is already happening. I think the problem is whether it's happening fast enough, right? And is at the pace that we need. And it's actually, is it addressing all those multiple things that we have ahead of us? I think. And you alluded, so actually I want to pick up on something that I really like what you said about, like, we can't afford TalkFest. And then we have to come up, you know, for the next generation of NDCs. Like, in your view, in your ideal, like, if you could, you know, if you had a magic wand, like, what are the key elements of these next generation of NDC? What should they look like? Like, just the contours of it.
Well, the three instructions that have come out of the COP decisions, and that is this next round of NDC should be informed by the output of the global stocktake. Mm-hmm. So whether that is doubling, tripling renewables, energy efficiency, transition away from fossil fuels, et cetera, all of those elements need to be reflected in this next round of NDCs. Also, that NDCs need to be 1.5 aligned. We're currently globally at 2.7. Mm-hmm. So has to be aligned with 1.5. They have to be economy-wide across all sectors. And they have to include all greenhouse gases. So that's one element. But I think we then have to go beyond that. And the opportunity that is being presented is that this next round, this third generation of NDC, has to clearly articulate how finance is unlocked. And that is the element that has been missing from the previous two generations. A lot of technical data, but how do the nationally determined plans of each country, how do they speak to the finance that is needed? So one is the investability of them. The other is an opportunity to present an economic transformation plan.
Yeah.
So how do all of these actions actually tie up in bolstering economies? How can all of these prescriptions add up to a new economy that is based at the heart of it in climate positive action and linking the climate to all developmental needs. The NDCs also need to be country driven. So this is especially for developing countries. This is not about parachuting consultants and coming up with theoretical documents. They have to speak to the needs of those countries. And the support that is provided over the course of this year and next is ensuring that articulation is there. And within that, and speaking specifically to developing countries, NDCs also need to speak to equity and justice. So taking a whole of society approach, whole of government approach is absolutely critical, but it's an opportunity to rethink. And we at the UNFCCC have been working with development and implementing partners as to how, and there are over 50 of us in this space working on NDCs, but how can we, as those development partners, coordinate our actions so that they speak to providing that support and shining the light as to what a good NDC should and could look like.
Yeah, and you know, I grew up, you know, born and raised and grew up in an emerging economy, right? And I think the real challenge that we have ahead of us is that climate transition is a socioeconomic transition challenge that we have, right? So it's not, from where I'm coming, is it's not about whether we should or should not develop. It's just like how we choose those pathways to develop that delivers the environmental aspects, but also the social aspects. And that's actually, I cannot leave this conversation just between of us without talking about Brazil, right? So the current president of Brazil brings, in his inaugural speech, he talked about the importance of conservation of the Brazilian Amazon, also how Brazil should go through this green development pathway. But also he brings very squarely into this transition discussion on how do we address the social issues and inequality issue. Because I think that's one of the things that could be one of the potential impediment or enabler. Like, do we bring people along in this transition, or do we leave people behind, right? What we see today in Europe of like the protests is like, how do we manage this political economy of transition? And then what are the social, it's delivering for all, which is what you're saying about the fairness angle there. About Brazil. So Brazilian, love Brazil, worked for many years in the Brazilian Amazon. I think I have a concern and simultaneous as an opportunity and as a concern is, I wouldn't want us to wait for everything, to wait for 18 months, right, to deliver whatever we need to deliver. And then expecting Brazil for the COP30 to be the place. We have things that we have to deliver in COP29, we have things that we have to deliver in COP30, and also we have what happens afterwards. What is your view about sort of the different paces, but also what are the key objective that we need to deliver now in Baku? What are the things that we need to do in Belém? And what needs to happen afterwards?
So one of the concepts I came, when I took up this position, instinctively I knew that how we look at the process, we look at every COP as a singular destination. And this concept of having a multi-COP agenda, how can we find ways of actually joining up COPs, the agenda, so that we create, well, first of all, set the context as to longer term, what is it we're trying to deliver, and how does that break down over those mandated items for each of the COPs, and how can we provide, how can we start to synchronize those, but how can we also create more oxygen within the negotiating space so that negotiators don't come to the table wanting to achieve absolutely everything in a highly difficult, complex environment. But I didn't know what that actually meant in practice. But what we have seen with COPs 28, 29, and 30, so the delivery of the GST in Dubai, which sets out the plan for this next period, how finance then locks into that and supports the delivery of that path, and then how that is articulated country by country through their NDCs, and how these three COPs are actually interdependent and interlocked. So there is certainly that three-year horizon. So where we are right now, it's delivering on the outcomes from Dubai. So COP28 is still live. But how does that translate into the finance agenda? How does that articulate into the new generation of climate plans? And then within that, we interlace, there are other deliverables too. And coming back to what a good NDC should look like, the issue of adaptation. Mm-hmm. How do we incorporate adaptation into these national climate plans? And the opportunity for, again, a revisioning of how we treat our national adaptation plans. So that is also something that's actually live right now. And the biennial transparency reports, which are delivered this year, which shed light on what countries are doing and not doing, and there will be this constant reporting cycle that, as I said, sheds light on what is happening there. And then, of course, what is happening with Article 6 with carbon markets. All of these things, all of these things are live and interlocked. So there is a clear path as we, within the Secretariat, we have this 360-degree view of what is happening. There is a clear story to be told, which we've started to articulate, and then where each of the COPs then fit into that. And with, we have this unique situation right now where we still have a very active presidency, the UAE, who are pushing forward, building on that momentum, vested in ensuring that the outcomes of Dubai are actually implemented. We have Azerbaijan as the incoming presidency, who are shaping the agenda and what needs to be delivered this year. And we have a very, very active incoming COP presidency with the Brazilians. So we're in this position where we have these three energies, but focused on delivering a strong 1.5 aligned outcome, whether in finance, whether in emissions, whether in adaptation, and all of the other peripheral agenda items.
Thank you. And allow me one last question, but I want to sort of link it to on your speech about, you know, there are things that you can do within the UNFCCC, but you're relying on handing the ball also to other international fora, like the G20, like the G7, or, you know, so there is like this, like in my mind, sorry, this is probably not a good example, like the synchronous ballet, underwater ballet that you're, anyway, but probably that's not a good thing, but I was just like, you know.
I'm not a good dancer. So.
I'm not a good swimmer, but I was just trying to sort of imagine like this kind of handling things if we're moving towards the same direction. So I just, could you just, as you're talking about those three different countries coordinating, but there are also different international foras where you're handing the climate change implementation challenge, but then you need to pick it back, right? Just in your view, do you have a bit of that, how that dance happens?
Yes, so the COP itself, I mean, that is the party-driven process, that is the space for the climate negotiations, and it has been that way for the last 32 years. But what is becoming more and more clear, there are so many other fora outside of the COP that directly influence whether it is the dynamics of the negotiations within the COP or the action that needs to be taken within the real economy. So again, when we look at the trajectory for this year, in a few days' time, we'll all be in Washington, D.C. for the spring meetings. That is about finance. So yes, this year within the process, it's all about the new collective quantified goal, the new, you know, how the 100 billion transform into the trillions. But it's very, very process driven. And what is going to drive progress there isn't only about what takes place within the process, but it's what takes place in Washington,
exactly.
What will be discussed in Washington, D.C. So how do we bring, infuse that into the play? We also have the role of the G7, as I articulated, the role of the G20. So Italy, Brazil, with their respective responsibilities, have a heavy lift as well in terms of setting the agenda and making progress and sending the right signals that are going to complement the decisions that will be made in Baku, in Belém, and within the process. So how one coordinates that ensures that there is the correct and appropriate plugins,
yeah.
So that, as I said, we can take that more holistic approach and view.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you for indulging me for my personal conversation. I'm going to do a round of questions, three questions, and then I'll hand over to Simon. And then I'm going to go back. Okay, so we have a gentleman here with a beard. Do we have some ladies? Okay, there is a lady, Ruth, over there. And then I have another lady on the blue top behind. I'm going to go do a bit of a gender balance here.
Thank you, Anna. Richard Hill. You talk about every voice counting and every voice matters and taking bold action. How do we counter that against a polarised political view that's happening across the world where it's one side wants to do something and the other side doesn't? It's becoming really strong, especially if you look at America and Britain, especially where we see action on climate being drawn back. How do we change that political landscape where voices can actually count as individuals? Because we need to change, but it's just not happening fast enough.
Okay, how to make voices count. Ruth?
Also on making voices count, under the Paris Agreement Article 12, countries are committed to informing and engaging the public on climate change. Until they do that in a meaningful way, it might be difficult for some citizens to understand what is at stake. So what more should governments be doing around Article 12 and Action for Climate Empowerment to enable people to understand what they face and speak up about what they need?
Thank you.
Can you hear me okay? Yes, Laura Kelly from the International Institute for Environment and Development. Really great talk on linking the different institutions and processes together, Simon. What about the CBD? Nature, of course, nature-based solutions, a key way to address climate. There's also demand for finance there. How do we link these agendas up? Thank you.
Thank you. So first round of questions for you.
Okay, thank you. So if I link both Richard and I think Ruth's questions, I think increased public awareness is what's happening in living rooms with ordinary people all around the world that I think is the key to creating that pressure and awareness, whether that is to cabinet rooms or whether that is to boardrooms. So I think there is a dynamic there that is important to take note of. but people need to be aware, both in terms of what is happening with climate change, and we're, I think progress has been made. The climate denial forum is still very active and certainly entrenched in vested interests. But I think in terms of the general public, I think there is an increasing awareness of the realities of climate change and the impacts, because we are seeing an acceleration, absolute acceleration of climate impact. So every region, every country, every community is now seeing and feeling it. But it's then also understanding, as an individual, what your role and your responsibility is, whether it's consumer choices that you make, decisions that you make, and how that can positively or negatively impact on decisions that are being made at state level or within corporations. So governments certainly have a major role to play in terms of, so whether it is enacting Article 12. But I think we've seen traditionally you can't leave everything up to governments. It's also how, for example, within civil society, how does civil society engage? And we're finding, seeing within the process more and more active engagement of civil society and having their voices not only heard, but also felt. And I think in the period that is ahead of us, I think there is room for even more activity and focus there. With regard to, so this year, with the three Rio conventions have their COPs. So the Convention for Desertification as well as Biodiversity and Climate. So there is an opportunity. We are speaking, the three convention secretariats, how we can ensure that, that there is some level of appropriate coordination to make this this moment count. We're also seeing between those three conventions the alignment of agendas in terms of what the issues are and what prescriptions are required at a global level to address them. And of course, the call on finance is central to addressing all three. So there is a moment right now. So certainly at a secretariat level, with our very clear mandates and responsibilities to each of those conventions, but looking how in an appropriate way we can work together to make this year as impactful as possible across those three conventions.
Thank you. There's quite a long list of questions online on the Q&A. I picked, using my privilege of being the chair, I picked one question. I'm going to put it here, and then I'm going to open for another. So one of the questions here is actually around the role of the private sector, which I want to put that question here. And then the gentleman here. I'm going to pick the lady with the glass here. And there's another gentleman over there.
Thank you very much. The carbon dioxide concentration, sorry, John Warren. The carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere is about 30% higher than the maximum safe level, and the rate of rise is increasing, therefore we are failing. Each successive COP, with tens of thousands of people flying into air-conditioned hotels, has increasing carbon footprint. How can COP sell the message of the need to reduce consumption? Mm.
Where was the other one that I had said? It was here, right? Yeah.
Hi, I'm Sheldon Dubay from the British Fashion Council. So with a particular industry in mind, and Simon, what you were talking about in terms of focus on NDCs, given the enormous footprint, environmental and societal as well, when it comes to the fashion industry in particular, how do we, as an advisory body with the UK government and with the UNFCCC, get fashion to be recognised as part of the NDCs for the UK?
Thank you. And then there is a gentleman.
Tim Stickings, I just wonder, Mr. Steele, what you make of the European Court ruling yesterday saying that there's a human rights mandate to take action on climate change. Do you see it that way, or some politicians in the UK have suggested that constrains legitimate debate about what should be done? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So, first of all, so the role of the private sector, absolutely essential. So we work in this, you know, within the UNFCCC, it's a climate bubble, but a necessary one, and that provides the framework for the changes, for the transitions, the transformations that need to take place externally. And where the needle actually moves, where action really happens, is within the real economy. And within the real economy sits the private sector. So an absolutely vital role. And how we integrate the private sector, again, appropriately within the process, and there are there is space that is created within the process, not only to give them a voice, and there's controversy there in terms of are those voices advocating for pro-climate action, or is it, again, advocating for vested interests?
Yeah.
So that is a very, very controversial space. But we have to find ways of breaking through that and engaging. And the cooperation and the alignment of the private sector to the goals of the Paris Agreement are absolutely essential. And we see momentum built in the various alliances within the private sector space. We are seeing greater coordination and alignment with Paris, but it's still nowhere near where it needs to be. But these are breakthroughs, or certainly challenges, that we have right now, and a central focus. With reducing consumption and every COP we get the reports, you know, how many private planes, the CO2 footprint for hosting those COPs. Taking a very pragmatic view, we need the right people around the table in order for this process to work, and there will be a cost. There will be a cost to that. How you ensure that those who those that are present are the ones necessary to contribute positively to the process is also important. But an opportunity that we have is re-looking at the process as a whole. So volume bigger doesn't necessarily mean better. We saw in Dubai record numbers of participants, but we also saw some of the strongest outcomes of a COP in recent times. But size does not necessarily translate to the quality of outcomes. We have an opportunity with Azerbaijan, and we're engaging with them. And certainly, based on some of the logistical challenges that will be presented in Belém for COP30, actively discussing with the Brazilians how we can reduce the size of the COP so that the logistics of it can be supported at that hosted destination, with the focus on the quality of the negotiating outcomes. So I would, if I share my own personal view, I would certainly like to see future COPs reduce in size, but the quality of the outcomes, the space created for those negotiations, as rich and impactful as possible. And as we start re-envisaging how the process could look in the future and the opportunity to make some shifts there, with the approval of parties, of course, is there. And then footprint for fashion. There is the Fashion Charter. And so there is a formal space within the UNFCCC process to engage the fashion industry. The footprint is a significant one. There is a coalition of the willing within that sector to identify far more sustainable ways of production and consumption. So the space is there, open to how that can be strengthened. And then human rights, I don't want to step into areas that are outside of my purview, but when we start to truly internalize the impacts of climate change on societies, on communities, on people, then that human rights question certainly looms large. So it's an interesting space for this debate to step into. I believe anything that can increase, and it comes back to the earlier question about public awareness, that increases public awareness and the impacts, especially on the most vulnerable, I think can only be a positive thing.
Thank you. I have another question here online, and it's to dive deeper into the finance piece, but from a private finance perspective. And so the question here is, what would you like to see from commercial banks, institutional investors, and investors? What kind of action do you want to see from them this year towards Baku? So that's one question online. I have a lady there on the back, you. I'm just trying to catch people on the back. Okay, I'll give you. And then somebody, gentleman here. It's the waving that works, right? Sorry.
Hi, Claire Jervis from Web, a impact investment firm. You mentioned earlier the need to accelerate the transition away from fossil fuels and carbon pricing being a particular mechanism to do that. It seems to me that carbon pricing mechanisms so far have proven fairly ineffective in actually bringing about an acceleration away from fossil fuels. So I'm just curious to know, what would you say have been the challenges there? What are the opportunities to overcome those challenges? And is carbon pricing still really the best mechanism to do that?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And then I think there was somebody. Oh, so gentleman here, and then the gentleman there.
Thank you. My name is Jaroslav Malach. I am a research fellow at UCL here in London, and I have some background in climate finance. For more applied sense, you were talking about MDB's reform, there's clearly a failure by leveraging and mobilizing private capital so that we get less than $1 from public finance to developing countries, and MDBs are clearly reluctant to do so because they need the same amount of capital assurance as they do for loans. So my question is rather, is there any thinking within COP process and UNFCCC about looking into some other solution platforms rather than MDBs, in particular in relation to risks, risk guarantees, which, for example, agencies like CEDA or USAID have very good experience of leveraging with much higher rates. But it seems there is no dedicated institution that would address climate finance and go just beyond loans and MDB's poor delivery on that.
Dr. Robert Chris, independent researcher and author and an associate of the Centre for Climate Repair at Cambridge. I'd just like to thank you for a very clear and compelling presentation and great rhetoric. But remembering that the climate system is also an actor in this, and the climate system is not paying attention to our rhetoric. So, and things are getting worse. The climate system is not in the same state today as it was 30 years ago, not even as it was when the last IPCC report was published two, three or four years ago. So let us optimistically assume that all of the constituencies to which your rhetoric is directed do their thing. What I would be grateful is if you could say something about whether the UN still considers net zero emissions, whether by 2050 or even sooner, to be sufficient to avert the widespread economic collapse and societal collapse that you referred to in your talk, or whether the time has come when prudence dictates that net zero needs some help from other interventions, such as, for example, to cool the planet directly by some form of intervention on albedo.
On?
On increasing the sun's, the planet's reflectivity.
Right. Easy questions.
Okay. All right. So, private finance and the role of commercial banks. So, what the 100 billion taught us was, it taught us many things, but one of is that the availability of public finance, even if that was increased, is still insufficient to meet the challenges of the climate crisis. So what is being discussed both within the process and outside of the process, and I think this links to Terence's question, but how does one leverage the limited public finance to attract the private finance that is necessary to turn the billions into the trillions? So the role of of private finance to fill at least part of that space is absolutely critical right now, and that is what is under the microscope in the finance discussions in the lead up to COP29. So how can, whether it is the de-risking, whether it is the reform of the MDBs, whether it's the reform of actually the global financial architecture. But what is broadly recognized, and I will link this to the rhetoric. So right now, these are just words. What is necessary is actually converting those words to real demonstrable action. And where we are within the process, the negotiations have actually ended. In reality, there are enough rules, there is sufficiency of framework, of guidelines as to what countries need to do, what non-state actors need to do. It's clear. It's turning rhetoric into action. And on the finance side, we have seen an alignment of that rhetoric and the language both politically and institutionally, as to what needs to be done within the finance space. I am not a finance expert, but there are many experts out there who have put forward different frameworks, different modalities, different concepts as to how public and private finance can come together, whether it's addressing credit ratings, credit risks, whether it is leveraging factors, whether it is leveraging balance sheets, et cetera, how this can work in practice. So there's no shortage of theory here. What needs to happen is the channeling of all of that to concrete outcomes, both in Baku and the discussions that take place at the IMF and the World Bank over this period. But more importantly, the actions and the political signals that come out of the G7 and the G20 on finance, on climate and development finance over the course of this this year. So I hope I've answered at least two or three questions. Carbon pricing. Carbon pricing. Is it the best way? It's one of. What is clear is carbon pr- pricing, carbon markets have the potential to address some of the calls for innovative sources of finance. The challenge that exists is the immaturity and the abuse of what currently exists. One of the outcomes we were supposed to have achieved in Dubai that we did not was with regard to Article 6, which is the article that speaks to carbon markets. It's expected that in Baku at COP29, agreements will be made that will start firming up the framework for the operationalization of a system that not only speaks to unlocking potential sources of finance, but also speak to the environmental integrity that's absolutely essential for this market to work. So it's the potential is there. Let's see what the coming months bring.
Okay, we're at. We're at time. I'm so sorry.
I didn't answer your question. We know what is needed, absolutely needed, to reduce emissions. And that speaks to actions that need to take place in the fossil fuel space. That is where focus needs to be placed. So whether geoengineering has a role to play or not, I see right now some interest in technology, unproven, keep doing the research. But right now, let's not get distracted from the concrete actions that governments, sectors, businesses need to take, that we know what needs to be done. We just got to do it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We have to close. Thank you very much.
And now we have something of a bonus. We have an episode from Outrage and Optimism where Tom Rivett-Carnac gets to speak with directly soon after Simon Steelmase's presentation, talk with him about what he said and why he said it. And then Tom and two of his counterparts get to dive headfirst into the heart of Simon's speech. Let's listen to those few minutes now. And you'll find a link for that in the show notes.
Hey, everyone. So I'm speaking to you from the streets of central London. I'm just walking along Jermaine Street on my way to Chatham House, where Simon Steele, Executive Secretary of UNFCCC, is going to be giving a foreign policy speech where he is going to set out the next 2 years to COP30. This reminds me of the years when Christiana and I used to be at the UNFCCC and she would come here once a year and set out a big policy speech that determined the direction of where she saw the negotiations going. We worked very hard on those speeches, so I'm sure there's a lot been going on behind the scenes, and the timing of this one is really interesting. So listeners will remember that we are a couple of months out from the negotiations in Dubai, the Dubai Consensus, and all of the efforts that went into that. And we now have this critical two-year period through to the COP in Brazil at the end of 2025, with a way marker in Azerbaijan in Baku at the end of this year. Those three countries, the UAE, Azerbaijan, and Brazil, have come together to form what they're calling a troika, which is the combined geopolitical diplomatic power of those three countries to try to get the world to move towards a step up in nationally determined commitments by the time we meet in Brazil that can get us back on track for 1.5. So the stakes for that couldn't be higher. If I'm honest, what I'm hearing behind the scenes is that coordination of that group is not yet what it needs to be. There's not really clear strategy, there's not consistent outreach, we're not entirely clear as to whether or not the critical countries are going to be willing to step up and go further in that time frame. So there's a lot at stake and the risk levels seem to be extremely high. So at this moment, for the Executive Secretary to come to Chatham House, Venerable Institution of International Affairs in London, and set out in a speech that he's calling 2 years to save the world, it will be very interesting to see his plan, to see how specific he is and how he's intending to address these gaps. There's a small queue. I'm going to join it and go inside. Hi, listeners. This is Tom here. This week, we're doing something different on the podcast. As you just heard, I have been in London recently, and I went to Chatham House and heard Simon Steele give his landmark speech, 2 years to Save the Planet. And afterwards, he was kind enough to give me some time to sit down with him and talk about the speech, what the implications of it were, where he was driving. Let's go to that first. And Paul and Christiana will join us after we play the clip for some analysis and some conclusions. Simon Steele, that was a cracking speech. It's really nice to see you sitting here in Chatham House. I actually remember being here 10 years ago and seeing Christiana give a companion speech 2 years before Paris. So it was lovely to sit there and see you up there and hear the narrative. And it was delivered with real passion, real commitment. You're a man in a hurry. So it's great to see you. And I'm going to kick off with a question. So I've got to say, it felt like a really no-nonsense speech. You were super clear. There wasn't a single UN acronym in there. And it was strongly connected to the broader issues around climate and the benefits of action. You talked about health and jobs and farmer livelihoods and gender equality and economic inequality. I heard you talk about the cancer of inequality. And it felt like you were laying out the stakes, but also to someone like me who's been in the process, maybe there was an undertone that actually you're actually quite worried about the political support for climate, for the agenda that you have responsible for delivering multilateral outcomes on, and that maybe you feel like the support is not where it needs to be to get you to where you need to be in 18 months' time. So I would love to invite you to go a bit deeper on that.
Well, thank you, Tom, and it's certainly great to be here at Chatham House, and all those that have been here before me, I know I'm in very, very good company. But I think on the geopolitical front, I think there are two narratives at play. One is the heavy headwinds that we see before us. This year, half of the world will be going to the polls. And how that translates into any policy shifts with regard to climate, I think everyone should be kind of concerned. But it also provides a space where voices can and should be heard. You know, there is climate is up there on the agenda. It is on the global agenda. We have seen in recent periods, this sliding down the political agenda, where in reality amongst the populations, I spoke of the recent Gallup survey, 130,000 people in 125 countries surveyed, and 89% expressed their concerns for climate impacts. And what we are seeing region by region, country by country, are climate impacts impacting everybody, affecting everybody. And with each year that passes within the public sphere, that awareness is there. But we're not seeing that translate into some of the decisions that are being made. So that's one narrative. Mm. The other narrative that I think is equally important and where I do have hope is the robustness of the Paris Agreement. Mm. And we are seeing in these very, very difficult times, we are seeing multilateralism working within the climate sphere, certainly as far as the outcomes we saw from Dubai, with a sufficiently strong outcome of the global stocktake and the pathways forward for closing both the ambition and the implementation gap. In addition to, you know, coming out of Dubai, transitioning away from fossil fuels. Mm. Yeah, two years ago, did we think, you know, let alone in Paris, that we would be seeing this text in a COP outcome? So we are seeing progress and a level of resilience within the process that despite what is happening externally, parties can come together and eke out at least a baseline of progress that is sufficient to keep the process going. Is it enough? Absolutely not. Mm. But that is what I see the challenge, the challenges before us.
Now, please don't forget, you'll find the link for that Outrage and Optimism episode in the show notes. Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It was just great to have you along. I was just fascinated by what Simon Steele had to say, and I really hope you were too. And I hope you will share it. I'd love you to share this podcast and let people know what's really happening with the climate crisis. Now, I'd love to hear from you what you think about this podcast, so please let me know. r.mclean7@icloud.com. Don't hold back, good or bad, please let me know. Also, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast. So again, using that email address, you can contact me and I'll contact you via phone and we can talk over that, or we can use Zoom and we can talk over that. So please let me know who you are, what you want to say, and we'll talk. Now, until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now take care and stay safe. Also, don't forget to check out the show notes, as you'll find a few links in there, one for Chatham House, another for Outrage and Optimism.